terrorist organization. There are also concerns that the Tigers are behind the human smuggling operation as a way to raise money. And it's believed that many of the people on board the ship may be sick. Canada has become a target for international smugglers. Rohan Gunaratne, a Tamil expert and head of Singapore's Center for Political Violence and Terrorism, says this cargo ship was initially headed for Australia, but changed course after the crew realized Australia had beefed up its refugee laws. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
The Colombian government's calling today's car bombing in Bogota a terror attack. There's no word yet, though, on who detonated explosives outside Caracol Radio, one of Colombia's most popular radio stations. Authorities say no one was killed, but several people were injured. Ecuador has been shaken by a 6.9 magnitude earthquake. It was centered in the Amazon region of the country. No immediate reports of deaths or injuries. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org.
Police were stumped by the murder of a restaurant manager until Richard Walter saw the crime scene and concluded it wasn't a robbery.
I found then that the primary focus was an intense anger against the victim.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Richard Walter about investigating cold cases and with Michael Capuzzo, author of The Murder Room. Join us.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is funded in part by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council, a state agency.
Good morning. This is the second hour of Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. Oil is essential to the world's economy. But interestingly enough, for countries that possess it, oil can be a very mixed blessing. Our guest for this hour, journalist Peter Moss, says that one of the ironies of oil-rich countries is that most of them are not rich. He says their oil brings trouble often, rather trouble rather than prosperity. This morning, we'll be talking with Peter Moss about his recent book, Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil, a book that has just recently come out in paperback. It's published by Vintage, so you can certainly find it in the bookstore. It's a book that takes a look at some of the social, political, and environmental impacts of petroleum, particularly on the countries that produce it. And as we talk, questions are welcome. We always invite questions. However, we ask people to please make it a question. Try and be brief. Keep it on the topic. That way you'll make room for other folks to call in, and we'll get as many as we can. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. You may also email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Our guest Peter Moss is contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine. He's also written for The New Yorker, The New Republic, The Atlantic, Outside, and Slate. He has reported for The New York Times, The International Herald Tribune, and The Washington Post. He's covered NATO and the EU. He's written from South Korea. He has covered Eastern Europe and the Balkans. And some people, in fact, might know him for his book, Love Thy Neighbor, A Story of War, which was about his experiences covering the conflict in Bosnia. That is a book that's out there, too, if you want to read it. And again, questions welcome at any point you want to call in. And Peter Moss, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Great to be on your program.
We appreciate it. Just in recent years, I think people have been talking a lot about the role that oil plays in conflict, geopolitical conflict. And it's something that interests you, too. But I know it's an interest that actually goes back some way. Even before 9/11, you were interested in looking at violent conflict and how often people talked about oil as being a cause.
Well, it really stemmed from my first book, which you mentioned is about the war in Bosnia, which I covered in the 1990s. And when I finished that book, I wanted to continue writing books, but I didn't want to write another book about a war itself. I had done that with Bosnia. I'd written about what it was like to be shot at, to see people be shot at. I wanted to write about the causes of war, or one of the causes of war. And it kind of, you know, emerged to me over a fairly quick period of time that oil would be a really good cause to focus on, because it's discussed so much in the sense of whether it makes people rich, whether it makes them poor, whether it brings conflict, whether it brings peace, et cetera. But I'd never never kind of read the sort of book that I wanted to read, which is one that, you know, went into these countries that produce oil and kind of evaluated through stories what happened to them, how oil actually had shaped them. So I kind of began, and actually it was 2000, to begin researching this, and, you know, went to Louisiana, and initially I was going to get jobs in the oil industry and kind of make oil interesting through my firsthand experiences working in the industry in different capacities. But after 9/11, oil became a much more kind of discussed topic, and the price of oil began going up and all that. So I realized I didn't kind of need to do that sort of trick, as it were. I could just go directly to these countries as a reporter and just kind of dive into them and you know, learn as much as I could and write as well as I could about how paradoxically oil, which, you know, you think you're rich if you get oil. It's like the Beverly Hillbillies. You go and live in a big mansion somewhere. But for the countries that possess it, for a lot of the countries that possess it, it ends up being more of a curse, unfortunately. Mm.
And that is really the striking thing here. You would think on the face of it, if you were an underdeveloped country and they discovered oil in your country, you would think, well, this is great. Now we have this great source of revenue. Prices are good. Everybody's going to want it. And isn't this a great thing for us to have this resource? But as it turns out, so in so many places, that's just not the case.
It can be useful and helpful for a while, but it tends to kind of, you know, bite you back at some point in time. There are countries that have avoided this problem, but they had the merit, and let's say Norway is the perfect example of that, a country that's rich in oil and gas. But it had the merit of discovering and solidifying democracy before it discovered and began selling oil and gas. And so all this revenue that, you know, comes in when a country discovers oil, it can be very corruptive. It can be very difficult to invest wisely. It can make political systems more resistant to change and openness rather than more open to those kinds of changes. So if you start out with a democracy, you're in good shape because you can kind of peacefully decide how the oil money is going to be used, and because it's an open process, you can also kind of decide in a way that's efficient. People can judge how the money is being used, what's being done with it, so that it's used well. But in closed systems, and that's unfortunately where a lot of the world's oil happens to exist, in systems that don't have democracy, that don't even have developed kind of civic institutions, the oil money overwhelms things. It turns people into thieves rather than good leaders. Yeah. It also makes it even more difficult just on a macroeconomic level for farming and manufacturing sectors to thrive. Actually, oil kind of, you know, seeps in or draws in all of the attention and all of the resources of the country, whatever it might have. And so you have other sectors declining, and that means that you become all the more dependent on oil. And when oil prices decline or when production declines, your government, all of a sudden, you don't have the money that you thought you'd have.
Yeah, it seems it's a situation that's just perfect for fostering corruption, because as you write about in the book, in so many places, it's the government that controls the resource. So a handful of people have control over how it gets developed, and so are in a position, an excellent position, to enrich themselves in the process.
Enrich themselves, you know, enrich whoever, whatever part of the country they come from, whatever tribe they come from or whatever, and that just, you know, increases divisions. One of the things that, you know, when we think of countries that have a lot of oil, you think, well, the country has a lot of oil. But actually, you know, oil, it's not like farmland where it's just kind of spread out evenly all over as far as the eye can see. Actually, in most countries that have a lot of oil, the oil is concentrated in just a couple of reservoirs. So there are parts of the country, let's say Nigeria, the Niger Delta, which has most of the oil. The Niger Delta has become a disaster zone for a lot of reasons that hopefully we'll be able to discuss, but other parts of Nigeria don't have oil. And so then you have this regional pull between the regions that have it, don't think they're benefiting enough from it. Other people in other parts of the country are getting resources without earning it or without having possessed the resource to begin with. And so it accentuates regional tensions where the tensions might just be kind of on a normative level that can be managed. When you throw all this kind of money into it, and it's like kind of a ship where all of a sudden, you know, one side of the ship has all of the oil, then it starts listing and it becomes very unstable. And that's one of the problems, too, that oil creates. It accentuates regional tensions between religious or ethnic groups in some of the countries that have it.
Well, in that, Nigeria, I think, is a perfect example of a broad spectrum problem, both environmental disaster related to the production, and then conflict around who benefits.
Well, this is, again, another factor where, you know, Norway had a great experience. I mean, it was a very well-developed country to begin with, and when oil and natural gas were extracted from its waters, it was done in a very environmentally conscious way. Norway had the technology, and they had kind of, you know, the consciousness, and quite frankly, they were able to afford, you know, conscientious, well-done, safe extraction. So it means that they're paying more to get the oil out, but less of the oil is polluting their waters. But when you're talking about a poor country like, you know, Ecuador, let's say, or Venezuela, or Nigeria, or Iraq, or Iran, for that matter, these countries don't have the environmental safeguards, the environmental history, the even the awareness of just how much damage oil extraction can cause. And they're not paying as much attention to what the companies that are extracting these resources are actually doing. And so the result can often be, and this is the case, Nigeria again, Ecuador, Venezuela, so many of these countries, where you have just really kind of environmental disasters, not because the technology doesn't exist to prevent them, but just because the technology isn't used, because the regulations don't exist or aren't enforced, or somebody's been paid off to look the other way.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Peter Maas. He is the author of a recent book. It's titled Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. The book has just come out in paper. It's published by Vintage, and questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You can also email will-talk@illinois.edu. The oil companies certainly have come in for a lot of criticism, and maybe with some justification. But you know what they say, and you've talked to people from the oil companies. They say, okay, what do you want us to do? You want gasoline for your car? We have to go where the oil is. And then when we get there, we have to deal with the people who control it.
And they have a point. There was an oil man I talked to. His name was Brian Williams, and he'd actually been indicted for tax fraud related to some money he'd received from an oil deal. And he was actually living in a halfway house when I talked to him. And I said, and he had been kind of caught up in all these major deals in the former Soviet Union. And, you know, I said to him, you know, we were talking about corruption, and he just kind of stopped me, and he said, look, you know, if you don't want us to get involved with these nasty countries, if you don't want us to kind of get our hands dirty and, you know, kind of sully morally perhaps the profile of the United States, then okay, we won't drill in these places. We'll just drill for oil in London and in Paris. But that means that in the streets of New York, you're going to be stepping over manure because you're going to be getting around on horseback rather than on cars. And you know, this is true. It doesn't exonerate him or any companies that, you know, cut corners and that kind of, you know, knowingly do things they shouldn't be doing, whether it's environmental pollution or whether it's corruption or whatnot. But what it does mean and indicate is that people here in America do indeed want their gasoline, and they want it as cheap as possible, and they don't ask questions about it. And so it's very easy to point your finger at these companies and say they are the problem, and they are certainly part of the problem because they can do much better. But they are indeed doing some of our bidding, and it's not all in secret. I mean, you know, you have my book, you have many other books, you have documentaries, et cetera, about how the system works. So we can know if we want to know. And in a sense, for whatever reasons, we look the other way. And you know, I'm trying to get people to not look the other way and to really kind of connect to what's happening on the other end of the gas pump.
Well, it seems like for consumers, really about the only thing people respond to is spikes in price. And their response is to complain. Their response is also to drive less. And if that is sustained enough, there does seem to be some interest on the part of some people in more fuel-efficient vehicles. But it seems that that's rather short-lived. And if the prices go back down again to what people consider to be a relatively reasonable or affordable level, then that concern just seems to just wither away.
Which is true. You know, when Nike was found to have been using sweatshop labor, et cetera, for making its tennis shoes, you know, consumers were a little bit concerned, and the company quickly kind of reacted to it. But, you know, you can buy another pair of shoes that aren't Nike, or you don't even need to buy a new pair of shoes as often as you might otherwise do. But you do need to fill up that gas tank. And, you know, because oil comes from so many objectionable places or causes so many problems, there's no kind of, you know, clean oil gas station to really go to. So indeed, it's hard actually for consumers to say no, but they do react when the prices are high. You know, when oil reached $147 a barrel in 2008, which meant about $4 a gallon gasoline, then you saw actually a diminution of the miles driven by people. They did react. Now, of course, the price has gone back down, but because of what a lot of people think, and I write about this some in the book, is this peak oil situation that we're probably in, prices are likely to rise again. So I think that in the end, because we do respond most to prices, prices might kind of be our ally in getting us to do what we need to do, because it seems likely that once the world economy and the American economy gets back on its feet, we're going to see much higher gasoline prices.
Yeah. And, of course, also people make the argument that the United States government has heavily subsidized this industry, and that has made it possible for Americans to have lower gas prices than in a lot of places. In Saudi Arabia, it's much cheaper. But also, a lot of places in Europe are paying significantly more for their gasoline than we do in the United States. And another of those arguments that people make is that, well, if the U.S. was paying more like what the world price was, that that also would have an impact on how people thought about driving and what kind of cars they want.
That's absolutely part of it. I mean, you know, the taxes have been slapped on gasoline in Europe and elsewhere precisely to get people out of big cars, to get people into public transportation. And, you know, as a result, people in Europe drive less, drive smaller cars, use more public transportation. And overall, the footprint of the average, carbon footprint of the average European is about a quarter less than that of an American. So, you know, that certainly is, you know, one of the factors at play here.
We have a caller here. Let's talk with them. Someone who is listening in Chicago on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Thank you. Some observations going back over 50 years, it was noted that the internal combustion engine was the biggest waste of oil and gas that we have. And yet, you're just talking about subsidies for the oil companies a moment ago. The taxpayers indirectly are subsidizing all this military that goes into maintaining our access to oil for the oil companies. And ironically, the oil companies are the richest business that the world has ever seen in history. So we are really paying a huge price indirectly for the oil and gas that we're using in our cars. And to say that it was a waste internal combustion engine, the use of oil and gas, along came the observation that oil is going to be running out and we better turn to alternative energy and so forth. And now we have electric cars and so forth. But the oil companies, automobile companies, stated that, we can sell cars that run on gas and oil, but let's start making electric ones. And then they observed, hey, listen, what's going to happen? Electric cars don't wear out. And the gravy in the automobile industry is the use of sale of parts and repair shops and on. So that's a big industry. So we're entangled in this sort of mess and quagmire of necessity for oil, for transportation, as well as other things. But so I just thought I'd briefly comment on it. But thank you for everything you've been saying so far. But the real costs are yet to be reckoned with. Thank you.
Well, I think the caller raises a great point that I've been doing some really interesting work on recently, I think, which is the externalized cost that you don't see at the pump, but you pay in other ways. And military spending is a really, really fascinating one because, of course, you know, there's not a tax at the pump for the amount of military spending that goes to protect oil supplies and guarantee secure oil supplies for America. But, you know, the fact is to some extent, and we can all argue over how much of an extent this is, the U.S. military, the by far largest in the world, exists in part to guarantee oil supplies. I mean, this is something that is, you know, a stated aspect of our national security policy. And if you look, there's a really fascinating report that was done by a Princeton researcher recently who kind of wanted to get away from the arguments over, well, is the war about oil and what war and to what extent, et cetera, and just looked at the cost over the past three decades of stationing aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf, because those aircraft carriers and the military forces around them are explicitly there for guaranteeing safe supplies of oil. And the figure he came up with, $7.3 trillion. That's $1 trillion. And that's just for aircraft carriers and associated military supplies and ships in the Persian Gulf. So if you, instead of, externalizing the cost, it just kind of, this comes out of the general budget, but made people pay at the pump what it's costing us militarily to guarantee oil supplies, then, and depending on the numbers you take and the figures you take and how much you say that the war in Iraq, for example, is tied to oil, you're talking about a couple of dollars to $5 or $10 or maybe even more per gallon added on to the existing cost if the military costs related to oil are put on at the pump rather than through general tax revenues.
Hmm. I think that's it's a subtle point, though, or maybe it's a little bit more complicated than often people say, because when people talk about, particularly about U.S. policy in the Middle East, or specifically things like the Iraq War or the first Gulf War, there's a lot of people toss around the phrase, well, it's all about oil. That's it. It's just all about oil. And you have to say, well, it's, yeah, it's about oil. And maybe a big part of it is about oil. It's not all only about oil. It seems a little difficult to tease out what the various things are that it's about.
I think the way to look at it is not so much like whether war X or war Y in particularly the Middle East is about oil, but the way to look at it is to ask how is it about oil, because it varies. 2003, the invasion of Iraq, was different from 1990-1991, the Persian Gulf War. Now, there is a very large general impression that it is all always entirely about oil. I mean, I went to Iraq in 2003. I was with the Marines that went into Baghdad. And a few days after that, statue of Saddam Hussein was toppled in Baghdad in 2003. I went to the oil ministry, and it was surrounded by American troops. And the city at that time was kind of just ablaze with looting and fires, except around the Ministry of Oil, because it was protected by American troops. And there were some Iraqis outside of the American cordon there who worked inside of the ministry but weren't being allowed in. And I talked with them, and one of them just kind of like tugged on my sleeve and said, look, you know, the Americans, they come in and they're protecting the Ministry of Oil, but down the street, the National Museum is being looted of its treasures, and, you know, all over this city, government buildings and private offices are being looted. It's clearly all about oil. That's what this fellow told me. And, you know, when you look at those kinds of symbols, yes, it seems very clear, but it is more subtle. I mean, I think that the invasion of 2003, oil was a central component to it, but not the only component to it. I mean, there was, I think, a fear on the part of our government of weapons of mass destruction, and the fear was paranoia of a sort, and it was resulted in evidence that was concocted and massaged. But it was a fear that existed, and it kind of connected with oil, and, you know, the result was the invasion. But it wasn't, you know, just because we wanted to have control over Saddam Hussein's oil resources that we went into Iraq then. Although 1990-91, that was very much a war that was explicitly about control of oil resources in the Middle East.
Our guest in this hour, Peter Moss. He's written for a number of publications, New Yorker, New Republic, Atlantic, Outside. He's also worked as a journalist for the New York Times, the International Herald Tribune, and the Washington Post. He's covered Europe and NATO. He's covered South Korea. He covered Eastern Europe and the Balkans. Maybe people will know him for his book, Love Thy Neighbor, A Story of War, which is all about his experiences covering the Bosnian conflict. And he has a new book out, and we're talking about that this morning. That title is Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. And it's now out in a paperback edition. It's published by Vintage. Questions are welcome. And we have somebody here ready to go. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And here's a caller here where we are in Champaign-Urbana, line one.
I discussed the Seven Sisters. Supposedly Getty was outside and could set his own price. The others worked like a cartel. But also, what do they mean by proven reserves? It used to be the companies would brag how much they lifted and sold. And now there's supposed to be a secret in some places, and there's a profitable business somewhere that tries to estimate the total amount of oil that enters world trade, because they can't get the data directly from the companies that keep it secret. Okay.
Oh, the Seven Sisters that the caller refers to were the major oil companies that for much of the 20th century controlled the world's oil resources. That's what kind of big oil was, these seven major oil companies. There's been actually a shift. I mean, we still pay a lot of attention here in America to Exxon, to Chevron, the big companies that we know quite well, to BP, of course, with what's going on in the Gulf of Mexico particularly. But what's interesting is that these Western shareholder-owned companies, which did control about 75% of the world's oil resources up until the 1970s, now actually only control about 15% of the world's oil resources. The rest are now in the hands of state-owned companies like Aramco, Saudi Aramco in Saudi Arabia, PDVSA in Venezuela, Iraqi National Oil Company, the National Iranian Oil Company. So now actually these big oil companies that we're really familiar with, as big as they are, as profitable as they are, they're not calling the shots as much as they used to. I mean, obviously in the Gulf of Mexico, BP was calling its own shots. And that's a region where, you know, it's only the Western shareholder-owned companies that operate. But in the rest of the world, most of the world's oil is not being extracted by these companies that are familiar with to us. It's by these other state-owned companies. And that's actually one of the things that, you know, when you look at the state-owned companies, as critical as I have been and I am and people are of how Exxon, how Chevron, how BP operates, the sad thing is that actually a lot of these state-owned companies are worse in terms of environmental care. They're worse in terms of transparency of their financial operations. So, you know, the development of the last 20 or 30 years, though understandable and justified in terms of understandable why a country would want to and should have control of its oil resources, have not necessarily led to, you know, a better deal for the environment. They have not necessarily led to a terrifically greater deal for the countries themselves, because the state-owned companies haven't necessarily been better than the governments that they are owned by, which in so many of these cases, as we've talked about, are quite corrupt and dictatorial.
Yeah. Well, let me come back to the second question of the caller in just a moment. There's a news item that I just like to pass on to people. We certainly here in Illinois have been following the trial of former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich going on in Chicago. The jury there has been in deliberation for 11 days, and there has been a development now. Apparently, the jurors in the trial have told the judge that they are deadlocked on 22 of 24 counts. That's what we have right at the moment. I'm sure that there will be more. We certainly have been following the story with great interest. People want to know how it's going to, what the windup is going to be here. So stay with us here on AM 580. We have more. We'll definitely let you know. To come back to the question of world oil supplies, you write in the book about a fellow named Matthew Simmons, who wrote a book called Twilight in the Desert. And in fact, he was on this show 5 years ago, in August of 2005, when we talked about it. He writes in this book, he makes this argument that the world might be at or maybe even past the peak of oil production. And it's been somewhat controversial. I think people, you know, some geologists have said, no, that's not right. Some people speaking for the oil companies say, no, that's not right. How do you think about the notion of peak oil?
Well, I tell you, first off, Matt Simmons, who I spent some time with and who really is kind of a fantastic figure and really innovative and brave, he passed away just a couple of days ago. So, you know, people in the oil community have been paying attention to that and thinking of that. It's a really fascinating situation, because what happened is Matt Simmons was an energy banker, a very successful energy banker in Houston. And in 2003, he went to Saudi Arabia on a kind of industry-sponsored trip and was given the usual kind of dog and pony show. And when he asked the Saudis, okay, now all these great oil reserves that you say you have and all the great kind of like nearly unlimited production that you say you can have in the years ahead, how do you know that's all true? And the Saudis basically told them, well, you know, mathematical algorithms, et cetera, because oil reservoir technology is very complicated. Just trust us on this. You know, you don't need to see the details and the numbers or whatever because they're confidential. And Matt Simmons has a very curious mind, and so he went back to Houston and did some research and found some old reports about the health of Saudi reservoirs as well as other reservoirs, and he kind of came to the conclusion that actually these countries aren't letting us know really kind of what the health and size of their reservoirs really are. They're not releasing data. It's not audited in any way. Actually, they're kind of bluffing, that they don't have as much oil as they say they have, and that they're not kind of running out of it in the sense of, like, in a year from now, they're not going to have any more to provide us, but they're not going to be able to continue increasing the amount that they provide to consumers, that we're at what's called peak oil. And when Matt Simmons came out with his book in 2005, it caused a great controversy, and it also caused, actually, a great awareness. The question hasn't been finally settled. It's still a great debate that's going on, but he really kind of made people aware that we don't know, actually, how much oil is underground and how much we're going to have in the days, months, and years ahead. And this is really important to know, because if there's not going to be more oil coming out of the ground, then we're really going to have to find other sources of energy, because the economy will grind to a halt if it doesn't have more oil to grow with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, although there's this big debate going on, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that Matt Simmons was right, that we are at the peak or perhaps beyond the peak. We don't know that yet, but it's a very lively, important question. You know, there's a really fascinating debate that goes on about, well, okay, if we are at the peak, then, you know, how quickly might we fall down from the peak in terms of oil production maybe collapsing? I don't think that's going to happen, but people do talk about that, and even if it doesn't totally collapse, what happens if it declines? Will the world economy kind of grind to a halt because of that? Will gas prices soar to such amount that nobody can afford to go from point A to point B? These are really, really important questions, and they're getting a lot more attention, and it's a good thing for us that they are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you look on the other side of kind of the doomsday worries, in a sense, if we are at peak oil, it could actually, although painful, be good news for us, because that would mean we're going to have to make this transition. You know we need to make the transition because of climate reasons and because of all the problems that we now realize oil actually has created. But without being forced to, we're still going to drive to the gas station and buy our gasoline for $2 a gallon or $2.50 a gallon, and that'll be that. But if we're at the peak and oil prices rise, then that is going to force us to make changes that we otherwise might not make.
Yeah. You know, just recently on the program, I had a kind of interesting and also sort of puzzling conversation with John Hoffmeister, who was a former president of Shell Oil, mm-hmm. who has a book that he was out talking about, a book titled Why We Hate the Oil Companies. And he, what's interesting and sort of puzzling about talking to him is that he sometimes talks like an environmentalist and then sometimes talks like the head of an oil company. And though his take on that is that he says, oh, we got more oil and we never know what to do with. But, of course, he would say, first of all, part of the problem is that they won't let us drill offshore, that's because there's a lot of it there. And then I think he would admit that that it is oil that's not – we're not going to be able to get it by the kind of conventional means that we used to. So it's going to involve new technologies, which no doubt will drive up the cost. But basically he says, you know, it's there. We know how to get it. The government isn't always very helpful in letting us do what we need to do, but it's there.
Well, I don't really agree with that, because there are several things that he's talking about that I don't think he talks about in the way that I would, which is when he says, okay, maybe it'll have to be unconventional oil. What he's, of course, talking about are what's known as tar sands up in Canada and shale oil, which is basically, you know, and particularly Canada and Venezuela also have a lot of these. It's oil that it's kind of proto oil. It's so trapped within kind of the earth that you basically have to kind of strip mine the earth and then boil the earth using natural gas or nuclear energy or whatever, and also using a lot of water to kind of wash out the oil from this earth that you're burning. And then you get this heavy oil that comes out of it, and it causes a tremendous amount of environmental damage, because you're removing the topsoil, you are burning this stuff, using a heck of a lot of energy, releasing a lot of carbon into the atmosphere. And it's quite a large environmental problem, and the Canadians are just becoming aware of it. So on the one hand, Hofmeister is correct. Oh, there's all this unconventional oil out there. But on the other hand, the environmental cost of squeezing oil out of these tar sands that are in Canada and in Venezuela is so high that that is going to limit how much oil we actually can produce this way, because we cannot afford, when I say we, I mean really, the Earth, citizens of the Earth, cannot afford to sustain the environmental damage that sort of extraction causes, and there's already a lot of opposition to it in Canada. So you kind of, I think, have to actually push off that part of the solution that some people in the oil industry point to. I mean, and they're very happy with that solution. They'd love it because it's business for them. It's big business for them. And when they say, like, well, if only we could drill in more places, you know, one of the places they'd like to drill in is, or at least explore in, is the Arctic. They think there might be a heck of a lot of oil underwater up there. And, you know, up until the BP disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, they were saying, look, you know, we drill offshore in the most incredible places. You know, we have the technology. We can do it. Don't worry. It'll be safe. There won't be any damage. Well, I think what's now been shown is that actually all of this drilling that the companies would like to do in places that have been beyond their reach or technologically or that have been disallowed for environmental reasons, all these places where they like to drill, we can't really trust their assurances that they won't harm quite severely environmentally these places with the kind of blowout that we had in the Gulf of Mexico. So I think that also is, you know, if you want to trust the companies to never have a blowout again, ever, then okay, let them go to all these places. But, you know, the last 100 years of the oil industry has shown that blowouts and spills are consistent. Each time these things happen, the companies say, okay, this was a rogue pilot of a tanker, this was a really bad well, this was a little service company that made a mistake, it won't happen again. And then it does happen again, in some other way, in some other place. So I think we have to be cautious about all these assurances that people like him provide us with. Yeah.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Peter Maas. He's a journalist and he is author of a book that's now out. It is out just now in paperback. The title of the book is Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. That's published by Vintage. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email well-talk@illinois.edu. Certainly here in the United States, ever since April, there's been a big focus on environmental impact of oil production because of the oil spill in the Gulf. I'm not sure that we hear quite as much about what happens anyplace else. Can you talk some more about the impact on the environment and health of people, particularly in, say, underdeveloped countries where they have oil?
Well, I went down to Ecuador, which is not a huge oil producer, but it's a significant one. It produces about 500,000 barrels of oil a day, most of which goes to America, and actually most of that goes to California, which is important to kind of keep in your mind because California has some of the strictest environmental regulations in America and, you know, has a ban on offshore drilling, a long-standing one. But what's, you know, kind of sadly ironic is that in Ecuador, where oil extraction began in the mid-1960s, it was conducted by Texaco. There's really been just a tremendous environmental disaster there. Oil was found in a province of Ecuador called the Oriente, and it was kind of, you know, wild Amazon jungle, virgin, you know, clear streams and nothing but green as far as you could see. And when oil was discovered there, then, of course, a big infrastructure was made to extract it. Roads are built, industry is developed. And that in and of itself, well, you know, when you find oil, you need to build an infrastructure. That's what happens. But the real problem was that Texaco, apparently, because it was operating way off in the wilderness at a time when there wasn't a big environmental movement going, even in as big as it is now in America, certainly nobody was paying any attention to Ecuador back then. And there was just a tremendous amount of really shoddy practices where oil was kind of spilled and put into unlined pits so that it seeped into the ground when kind of this water that often comes up with oil and that contains a lot of toxins and problematic substances is just kind of poured into the Amazon. Billions of gallons of that were allegedly poured into the Amazon. And the result is that if you go to the Oriente region now, 30 years later, and oil is still being extracted there, It's an environmental wasteland. I drove around there, and you can stop your car on the side of a road, and you won't see any oil wells around, but you'll smell oil in the air because it's been spilled somewhere nearby at some point in time, and it has never been cleaned up. And there's a huge lawsuit going on now against Chevron, which purchased Texaco a number of years ago and acquired its assets as well as liabilities. So the folks in Ecuador, environmental activists as well as some American lawyers, got together and filed a lawsuit against Chevron. And it's at the final stage right now. Judgment's expected quite soon. Judgment looks like it's going to be against Chevron, and damages could be in the many billions of dollars. Chevron is raising already quite a stink about this. But, you know, when you step back from it, this is something that, you know, it happened in Ecuador, but, you know, you go to Venezuela, you see the same thing. You go to Iraq, you can see, you know, similar types of devastation. Iran is a terrible situation, too. Parts of Russia, terrible extractions happen. But you don't have, you know, it's not the Gulf of Mexico. CNN just doesn't get there as quickly, or people don't care about it as much. But it happens, and it happens for our benefit. We benefit from it. That oil, which is polluting, you know, these places, is oil that is being sent to us. And I just try to connect, you know, what we use to the problems that it causes in these places. And I think also that one of the interesting things about the BP disaster is that, I mean, on the one hand, it has certainly raised our awareness of how devastating oil pollution can be and how it does happen. But in another sense, I'm afraid that one of the reactions to it is, well, we'll make it more difficult to drill in the Gulf of Mexico, we'll have better regulation, we'll find BP, and then we'll say to ourselves, we've done what we should do, you know, we solve that problem. But America only has 2% of the world's oil reserves. Most of the oil in the world is extracted elsewhere, and it can't be enough for us to just ban drilling on our territory and say, okay, problem solved. We're not.
Peter, Mr. Bowles, are you still there?
I'm here.
I thought I lost you for a minute there.
I am here.
Are you okay?
Yes, I'm fine.
All right. Anyway, here, what I need to do is take a pause here because I again want to bring people a little bit of an update on the Blagojevich story that we're hearing about this morning. We have a story here from the Associated Press. So I'll do that, and then we'll continue to talk for a little time more. Jurors in the former Illinois governor's corruption trial have told the judge that they have reached agreement on just two counts. They also told the judge today they've been unable to reach agreement on some counts and have not even discussed many others. The jury sent a note to the judge, James Zagel, yesterday saying that they were stuck, and then Zagel asked them for clarification. Blagojevich and his brother have pleaded not guilty to charges, including trying to sell or trade an appointment to President Barack Obama's vacated Senate seat in exchange for a high-profile job or large campaign contributions for the governor. Defense attorneys have argued that Blagojevich was a big talker, but he never committed any crime. So, again, that's what we have right at the moment. I'm sure as we hear more, the story will perhaps become a little bit more clear, but certainly people here in Illinois were following this, and the jury had been deliberating for, I believe, 11 days, and people were starting to wonder where the jury was, and at some point, would there be a verdict? So that's what we know right here at the moment. And again, as we have more information, we'll bring it to you. Once again, let me introduce our guest for this hour, Peter Moss. He is the author of the book Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. It's recently been published in paper by Vintage, so you can find the book. And questions, welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. You know, one of the things that I think it's really interesting is that, going back to something we talked a little bit about at the beginning, is the significance of having this as a resource and what it actually means if that's pretty much your only resource. You know, it sort of depends on what your economy is like. So in places like Nigeria, for example, or another place that you write about is Equatorial Guinea, which is a very small country that's on the Atlantic coast of Africa. You know, if that's all you got, that is going to be more of a difficult issue than if you're a place like the United States or like Canada, where your economy is a little bit more diversified, and that's not so heavily based in one natural resource.
And one of the key things kind of the lessons that come out of, you know, this traveling around and seeing all these countries is that, you know, actually it's more important than having oil is having jobs. And the problem with economies that are oriented almost exclusively around oil is that they don't have a lot of jobs, because the oil industry is really capital intensive. It doesn't, you know, it's not like farming. It's not like, you know, making cars or whatever. It just doesn't require a lot of workers. And so you have a problem in virtually, you know, every country that is dependent on oil and natural gas of high unemployment. And there are really fascinating reasons for this, because oil, it doesn't contribute to you know, much in the way of jobs. When I went to Equatorial Guinea, for example, Marathon, the American oil and gas company, was in the process of constructing a multi-billion-dollar natural gas facility. And so I went to this massive construction zone and was given a tour around it by the Oklahoman who was the manager. And all the workers, I looked around, the ones who were doing all the welding and pounding the nails or whatever, they're all from the Philippines, they're all from India. And I asked this the manager, I said, you know, why don't you have local labor here? And he said, well, actually, we do have some local labor. There's a very small number of people from this country who are working here. But basically, it's just much cheaper for us to bring in these laborers from India and the Philippines, because they've worked on big construction projects in the Middle East and elsewhere. They know how to do the job. They live on the construction site. They don't have malaria. They work 7 days a week, get the job done, and then they're gone. And that's much more efficient for this company to use that labor than to use and train up local labor. And so, you know, in the massive construction phase, very few jobs go to local people. And then kind of compounding the problem, compounding kind of the fact of the oil industry not contributing as much as one would want to economic growth, is that Marathon was importing directly all of the food and all of the, you know, the housing materials that they needed for people there. So the food that these Indian workers were eating, this was just brought in on a container ship and brought directly to the construction site. It wasn't bought from the local market. The wood that was used to you know, make houses and things of that sort, it was not bought from local suppliers of wood, even though there is a timber industry in Equatorial Guinea. It was imported in because, again, much easier to use these big suppliers that Marathon has a long-standing relationship with that deliver on time at, you know, quality that they're accustomed to. So this big construction facility where, you know, more than $1 billion was being sunk into it to build it, it might have been on the moon for all of the kind of inputs and connections that it had to the local economy. So this is, you know, another part of the problem of kind of being oil-centric is you don't get jobs, you don't get diversity, and you therefore have unemployment problems, and that creates all sorts of follow-on problems in the way of restive, understandably so, populations.
Yeah. Let's talk with somebody else here in where we are in Champaign County. This is Line 1. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to reprise your discussion about what it means for a war to be about oil. It seems to me that the planners take a long-term view of things, and I was chatting with someone, and they said, well, it seemed like in some ways the Iraq War was good because it kept the price of gas below $3 or something, which is really wrong-headed, because less oil is being pumped now than under Saddam, and so it's more the weakness of the world economy that means why prices are down. So that's one sort of point. The way conflicts and economic dominance is about oil is who controls it, not so much where it goes or when. And the Seven Sisters are really still pulling the strings with the sovereign oil companies, and a lot of that is crony capitalist. And you know, I don't know if you looked into the Nigerian case of Total and Halliburton, the one that was always sort of hanging around but never really discussed, was that when Cheney was actually involved with Halliburton when this huge bribe was paid to Sonia Bacha. And so that, you know, this is the way those things work. And I just think that to say something is a war is not about oil because it didn't affect the contracts that were cut in the last 10 years or subsequent to it is really missing the point of the long-term view of how the prize in the Middle East has been, quote, developed by mainly Western powers and the U.S. I don't know how you'll respond to that.
All right. Well, go ahead and make whatever response you like.
Well, I think the caller kind of raises a really good kind of issue that, you know, there are different points of view on, which is, okay, well, to what extent might the war in Iraq have been related to a desire on the part of the American government or factions within the American government wanting to actually be able to have American companies go into Iraq and extract its resources? Now, I think it's entirely reasonable to assert and to believe that there were people within the American government that thought, oh, this is great, we'll invade Iraq, and then the state oil company in Iraq will be broken up, and Iraq's oil resources will be extracted by Western companies, particularly American companies. And there was indeed, you know, a plan circulating around for privatizing Iraq's oil industry and perhaps even kind of Iraq withdrawing from OPEC so that it could produce as much as it wanted or as much as the companies there wanted. But to have some people in the American government, and this is kind of, you know, some of the neocons in the American government kind of talking and wishing, and some people in corporate America talking and wishing for this, doesn't mean that that was actually a reason and a wish on the broader part of the entire American government. And I think, you know, anybody who kind of knows the Middle East at all understood at that time, 2003, before it and afterwards, that there's no way that Iraq's oil resources were going to be privatized, and that there's no way that these oil resources in other OPEC countries that were nationalized in the 1970s, et cetera, were going to be privatized, that that is a boat that will never get out of the harbor. So, you know, to the extent that there were people in the American corporate world or government who wished that they could privatize Iraq's resources, yeah, sure. I mean, I'm sure of that. To the extent to which that really was a motivating force in the invasion of Iraq, I'm less sure of that.
All right. We're just about the point where we have to finish. I guess one wonders, given the heavy dependence of the world on fossil fuels right now and the infrastructure being built all around them and the challenges in developing alternatives, is anything in our energy picture going to change anytime soon?
Well, I think things are changing all the time in the sense of, you know, we are creeping along, not nearly as fast as we need to, not by a long shot. I mean, we're the laggards in this race. You know, we're far behind Europe. We're far behind China. But I think that particularly the price issue is going to be a catalyst, and I think that is going to be an issue. Gasoline is going to cost more, and that will be a catalyst. And I think there's reason to hope for that. And, you know, even, you know, I'm a 50-year-old guy, and it's easy for people like me to think, you know, when I encounter students and young people, oh, you know, they really get it, and they're going to change the world. That's kind of a trope that's been happening for a long time. But I do feel that. when I talk to younger audiences in particular, I just sense an awareness and a willingness to make changes. And I think, you know, we're seeing some of that. And this isn't specific to energy per se, but just I think we're seeing kind of like the cost of selfishness in this country. And I think that particularly younger people who aren't as rooted to the old ways are kind of seeing that, yeah, it's not all about getting the biggest house you can without caring about, you know, where the materials come from or where the gasoline comes from.
Yeah.
And so I think there is a lot of hope, actually.
We will leave it there. If you want to read more, look for the book Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil, just now out in paper from Vintage by our guest, Peter Moss. And Mr. Moss, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by the North First Street Association of Champaign, presenting the Farmers Market on historic North First Street in Champaign, Thursdays from 3 to 7 p.m., featuring locally grown produce and meat, crafts by local artisans, and family-friendly activities.
WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.
There have been some developments this morning in the corruption trial of former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. Jurors told the judge they reached agreement on two counts, but they also said they had been unable to reach agreement on some others and hadn't even discussed some others. And now the Associated Press is reporting that the judge will tell the jurors to continue to deliberate on the unresolved counts. More on that, I'm sure, coming up in the hour, this following hour of the Afternoon Magazine, and the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3. Urbana. In Kansas City, September wheat 745, up 35. December 759 and three quarters, up 35 and a quarter. In Chicago, September 730 and a half, up 35 and three quarters. December 761, up 36. September corn 412 and a quarter, up 16 and three quarters. December 427 and three quarters, up 16 and three quarters. March 440 and a half, up 16 and a quarter. May 447 and a quarter, up 15 and a quarter. August beans 1059 and three quarters, up 15 and a quarter. September 1033 and a half, up 17. November 1035 and a quarter, up 19 and three quarters. January 1041.